Is that better?
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Thanks, Steve. Thanks. All right. So we're coming to the end of Joshua's life. So he's remembering the good things that happened. You'll remember how they were, 400 years in Egypt, and then of course they crossed the Red Sea. They go to Mount Sinai. They get the old covenant there. The law. The Levitical system, the tabernacle, the worship service. I have delivered you from Egypt, God says. Now you need to obey the law and the Levitical system. They come up to the promised land here, you'll remember, and they were supposed to go into the promised land here. And they get to Kadesh Barnea, you'll remember, and that they say, no, there's giants in the land, we can't do it. So they wander around in the wilderness here for a while. Remember, they wander around for 40 years. And they finally end up here on the plains of Moab, over here. And you remember, they conquer those two kings, Sihon and Og, over here. And they conquer some of this land over here. You guys will remember that. Reuben, Gad, half of Manasseh's over here. And Moses gives them the book of Deuteronomy, standing over here looking over the River Jordan, but he's not there yet. And then great things happen. Great things happen. Under Moses dies, Joshua takes over. He crosses over the River Jordan on dry land miraculously. They conquer Jericho, then they Ai, then they come down here to Gibeon. And then they conquer all these places here, and they have some miraculous times when hailstones fall on the people and God is with them. And then they come up, then they go back to Gilgal, then they come up here and they conquer the northern part over here. And this all takes about 5 or 6 years. And they win almost all their battles. A little problem, obviously, with Ai, but God is fighting for them, sometimes miraculously, sometimes he just looks after them. After 5 or 6 years, you'll remember they have conquered the land and then they're divided up among the remaining tribes. Judah's over here and Simeon's over here and Benjamin's over here and Dan's over here and Ephraim's over here and Issachar's over here and Zebulun's over here. And all these tribes are over there. So this takes about 7 years. Then they divide up the land, and then each of the tribes goes to their own place. And so you got these 12. There's more than 12 tribes because Joseph had two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Ephraim had Manasseh had two pieces. The other half of Manasseh is over here. And so they go to the tribes, and then you'll remember we studied last time that God then had cities for the Levites in all of these towns, all of these areas. There were cities for the Levites, and the Levites, remember, did not have their own property, but they were scattered among the tribes, and they were to teach the people, they were to encourage the people, and they were dispersed among all of the tribes, and they were to live off the land owned by the tribes. Also scattered in there were the cities of refuge. Remember, there were three cities of refuge on each side that we talked about the last couple of times. And so this has been going on here for about maybe 25 years when Joshua gives his final speech. So they probably crossed the Red Sea about 1440 BC. They probably conquered the land about 1400 BC. Probably took them 5 to 7 years to actually conquer the land. Another couple of years maybe to divide it up amongst the tribes. And then you have a period of time that we don't read about between chapter 22 and 23 of maybe as much as 25 years. So Joshua is now getting old. He's probably close to 110. We know from the next chapter that he's 110 when he dies. So he's giving this speech. Probably he's 108, 109, 110. We're not sure if their years are identical to our years, but he's obviously fairly old, and he has run the course over here. So Joshua is, and the tribes are sort of trying to take over the area. And you remember the biggest problem we're having here is that these tribes were given their land, but they didn't always drive out the Canaanites. This was their biggest problem. God had told them, you know, when I give you this land, you're to drive out the Canaanites completely. Where did I?
Oh. Just make sure that's it.
Oh, sorry.
It's not good.
There we go.
I'm not sure why it's doing that.
Okay. You're to drive out the Canaanites completely and destroy them. And, of course, they didn't do that. And that becomes really the story for the next 800 years, that they never drove out the Canaanites, they compromised with the Canaanites and so on. So they've had about 25 years of sort of settling into the land, each one of their own tribe, and God has certainly blessed them, but they haven't yet driven out all of the people. And then Joshua gives this farewell speech. We don't know where he gives it from, but he probably gives it from Shiloh. Remember, Shiloh's about over here. Shiloh's where the tabernacle was set up, where the sacrifices were, where the presence of God was in the Holy of Holies. So right here in Shiloh is where he probably gave the speech. This thing of farewell speeches is kind of interesting because there are a number of farewell speeches in the Bible. First of all, if you remember, Jacob at the end of the book of Genesis gives a sort of a farewell speech when he blesses all of his sons. Moses gave a farewell speech really at the end of the book of Deuteronomy and the song of Moses. Joshua is giving a farewell speech. Samuel gave a farewell speech. David gave a farewell speech. A number of the prophets give things that could be farewell speeches. Jesus gave a farewell speech in the upper room. Remember that? And the Apostle Paul gave a sort of a farewell speech to the church at Ephesus. So farewell speeches are fairly common in the Bible. And they presuppose two things, which is probably helpful for some of us here. It presupposes, number one, that old people have something to say. Now, I understand that's not a commonly recognized truth in our culture today. Most often when old people get up to share what they've learned in life, the younger people sort of say, well, that was quaint. That was quaint. He gave a nice quaint speech. But biblically speaking, the Proverbs talks a lot about the wisdom of gray hair and things of that kind. And, you know, the reason that we, as you get older, you have something to say is we've traveled down a path that the other folks haven't traveled down yet. It's not that we're necessarily smarter than them or even necessarily more spiritual, but, you know, if you haven't raised teenagers, someone who's raised teenagers can tell you a little bit about the path. If you haven't sent kids to college, someone who has paid for them to go to college and struggled with what they come back like after the first semester and all those things, you know, you've learned something about that. And then when your kids get married, you know, you learn something about them choosing Christian wives and the struggles they go through, and because we had three boys. And then, you know, and then you have grandchildren, and you learn something about how you work with your daughter-in-law and your grandchildren and how you share Easter and Christmas and all those cool things. And then, you know, your grandkids start becoming teenagers, and hopefully as our thing goes on, our grandkids will get married and have their own children. And each place along the line, you learn something of a path that the people behind us have not seen. And I know that we happen to live right now in a hugely existential culture at the moment where the views of older folks are not really highly valued in most circles. And history has sort of gone up and down with that, and it'll probably go up and down in the future. You go through times when, you know, I was raised, you know, my dad came back from the Second World War when I was born. And, you know, our dads came back from the Second World War where they'd won that incredible victory. And they were heroes, you know, so we tended to listen more to older people because they had won that great Second World War. They came back as heroes. They mostly did well financially because we came back after the Second World War. And I imagine we'll go through phases like that in the past. Right now we're going through a very existential phase. So when you sit down with your sons and sons-in-law and younger people and tell them about what it's like to be married for 45 years and how it works and what it's like when your kids go to college, all these types of things, and they kind of glaze over like that. Don't give up, because they may learn something. Joshua obviously felt that he had something to offer, even at 108 years old. And so he felt like he did. Moses felt like he had something to offer, even though he was very old. So we have something to offer. Young people don't always accept what we have. And, you know, I kind of look back when I was 35. I'm not sure I listened as attentively to the old guy with gray hair. I think I was probably pretty much like 35-year-olds are now. But I did learn a little bit from them occasionally. So farewell speeches are important. I think we have a role in this life. It's a difficult role because we're going through an age, this postmodern age, which is so existential. And the other thing that's hurt us a little bit is that our 12-year-old grandkids are more knowledgeable about technology than we are. And that wasn't true 50 years ago. 50 years ago, grandpa taught you how to run the tractor, you know, because grandpa knew. Now the granddaughter is teaching grandpa how Kindle works and how iPad works. So you do have some funny kind of odd eddies going along there. But I think we have something very important to share. And I think that's a pretty cool deal. And I think we ought to do it. One of the guys in my Thursday morning group is a guy by the name of James May. A lot of you guys know James. He sits over there Sunday mornings. He's been coming here for over 20 years. He's a teacher at Corona Del Mar High School. But he tells a story that when he took his now wife up to Oregon to meet his grandparents, his parents and his grandparents, he tells the story. He's probably been married 20 years now, but he tells the story of this, that he went to his grandparents' place and they stayed there the night. And he said it was so cool because after dinner, his grandpa took out the Bible and read the Bible like he had done every night for years. And he said that was really impactful for his fiance, who was his wife-to-be. And if you know James, he's a strong believer, but you recognize he's got two generations coming down. He has got a godly grandfather, a godly dad and family, and now he's raising his kids for Christ. That's pretty cool. And that's a role we need to have here with our children, and particularly with our children, but with other people that God gives us a chance to mentor. And don't get ticked off with them if they don't listen to you. Because they're not going to listen to us most of the time. Maybe even when Joshua gave his speech, some of the younger guys said, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's got halfway between dementia and over the hill here. But I think we do have a role to share what it's like to go through the various stages of life. And I think we ought to, at the appropriate times, not be afraid to share some of that experience that we have done. Because you only learn experience by going that way. And most of us who've lived as long as we have lived have suffered some tremendous times of blessing and victory and success. But you can't live as long as we've lived without having some painful experiences. either in sickness or health or finances or relationships or something like that. And, you know, God enabled us to go through them, and that's it. The other thing that goes along with the farewell speeches is one of our great ministries as we're older is our families, you know, to pray for our children and our children and their spouses, and our grandchildren, and to encourage them. You know, we have this wacko program where we have two houses, which, by the way, is a very poor economic program, especially when you only live in one of them about three, I live in it probably 5 weeks a year at most. But the reason we have this big house in Virginia is because we have a son, a daughter-in-law, and three grandchildren there. And we think there's a value to Tina spending 3 to 4 months with our grandchildren. Well, with our daughter-in-law, because she lost her mother in a car accident when she's a teenager. So Tina's really her mother and mother-in-law all wrapped into one. And our grandchildren, because we have two granddaughters there. So we think there's a value to that, because my dad was really important in my spiritual life, even though he was in South Africa. But when he came over to America, we'd bring him over 6 weeks at a time. He got to know my kids in America better than my sister's kids that lived 100 miles away, because we'd bring them over for 6 weeks. We'd bring them over in the spring for baseball season. I had three boys. And we'd bring them over in the fall, 18 months later, for soccer season. And they just picked up with the kids. Oh, where's Mitch? Where's that? Oh, is he part of the team? What? It just kind of followed us. So they came regularly. My dad was a great prayer warrior and a great influence on me and our family and my boys. And we're trying to do the same with our family. And so I think we have something to offer. We haven't been put out to pasture. So farewell speeches, we have something to offer. At least the Holy Spirit and Joshua thought that we had something to offer, so we need to do it. And if they don't listen to you, don't worry. They're picking up more than you realize. Okay, Joshua 23, let's read it, this farewell speech here. The years passed, and the Lord had given the people of Israel rest from their enemies. Remember, they've finished fighting for over 25 years, probably. Joshua, who is now very old, because that, you know, we haven't reached that place yet. None of us are very old. We're just old. Joshua, who is now very old, called together. Interesting, he calls together the elders, the leaders, the judges, and the officers of Israel. So he calls together the leadership of Israel. And he said to them, I'm now a very old man. So unlike us in Newport Beach who try to pretend we're younger than we really are, he was not afraid to say, I'm very old. I'm now a very old man. You have seen, now this is interesting, because as we go through the speech, you see there's really three things going on. Consistently reminds them of God's grace, faithfulness, and promises to them. And then he also encourages them and warns them. Now this is a reminder. You here, standing here and listening to me, you have seen everything the Lord your God has done for you during my lifetime. The Lord your God has done it. You know, Yahweh, your Elohim. The Lord your God has fought for you against your enemies. You know, it gives them perspective. Yes, we have successfully conquered the land, but it's because God was with us, fulfilling his promises. Verse 4. I have allotted to you your homeland. Sorry, I've allotted to you as your homeland all the lands of the nations yet unconquered. Whereas I gave you this land, but some of it you haven't yet conquered. From the River Jordan to the Mediterranean Sea in the west. This land will be yours. This is the original version of, this land is your land. No. They sang it in Hebrew originally, then we kind of took it over here. from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. No, just, okay. All right. This land will be yours for Yahweh your Elohim. Remember, Lord in capitals like that is a covenant name, Yahweh. Elohim is the name of the mighty creator God. The Lord your God himself will drive out all the people living there now. That's really interesting. Joshua really believed when he died that not only had God given them most of the land, but God would help them drive out their enemies, which never happened. But he expected it to happen because God had been so faithful in the past. He says, just go in and do what you have to do. You will take possession of their land just as the Lord your God has promised you. So it's a reminder of God's blessing, his faithfulness, what he's done for them. So then, now he gives his little bit of exhortation. So the old man has now stopped talking about his stories of how God was faithful, and now he's going to kind of challenge him. And we need to be willing to do this. So, be very careful to follow everything Moses wrote in the book of instruction. That's the law. It's probably the book of Deuteronomy. At minimum, it may be the whole, you know, Genesis through Deuteronomy, because only that's all they had at the time. Now, be careful to follow most of the stuff Moses wrote in the book of instruction. Is that what it says? No. We are masters of compartmentalization. We are what some people call smorgasbord Christians. We go through the line and we pick and choose. We go to the buffet and we pick and choose. It's really important. So be careful to follow everything Moses wrote in the book of instruction. Do not deviate from it, turning either to the right or to the left. I mean, that's pretty clear, man. You know, God has given you in his grace and faithfulness and promises this land that he promised Abraham 600 years ago and kept on promising to you. He's fulfilled it. His promises are filled. You got the land. You're in place. Just one thing you got to do. Follow God's commands, and careful to follow them. It means you're going to know them, to follow them, and don't turn to the right or left. Don't deviate. You've got to follow all of them. And then he gives this first little kind of specific command, which is kind of interesting, because you'll notice in this speech he sort of escalates the warnings. Make sure you do not associate with the people still remaining in the land. Do not even mention the names of their gods, much less swear by them or serve them or worship them. Don't even mention the name of their gods, much less swear by them or serve them or worship them. Rather, cling tightly to the Lord your God as you have done until now. So that's you've done that right now. But you've got to cling to the Lord. Don't associate with these people. Now, that's kind of a little tricky for us to understand. You don't associate, because if you do, you may end up worshiping their gods. And you've got to understand a little bit about the culture there. The Canaanites who lived in this land here had a pantheon of about 70 gods. The big god was a sort of a fatherly figure named El, because, you know, El and Aramaic and Hebrew kind of has always meant God of some sort. If I figure the name God, who had a consort, but God's son, I'm sorry, El's son, Agareth, I think was her name, was the consort. Son's name was Baal, and Baal became the sort of big god that was worshipped amongst these people. And Baal had a lot of other gods. There were a lot of other gods that were related to Baal, but Baal was the big god. He was the storm god. And he was somehow related to fertility particularly. So the concern which happened was this, is that, you know, everything they did, they swore by their gods. And if you remember, one of the next books of the Bible, the book of Ruth, you remember when Boaz greeted his employees that were working on his farm there. As he greeted them, he said, "The Lord be with you." And they responded to him, "The Lord be with you too, Boaz." That was a common greeting. Well, if you're a Canaanite, you'd say, "Baal be with you." And the employees would say, "Baal be with you too." And when you entered into an agreement with a Canaanite, he said, may Baal punish you if you don't fulfill this thing. And you want to be courteous to the other person, so you start kind of going along with that stuff. So you have to be, and the danger was that they would then out of courtesy, maybe compromise, and slowly be pulled in a little bit more, and before you know where you are, you get pulled into the next deal. But the first step was don't associate with them. Be really careful of that, because one thing leads to the other. And, you know, we all have this greed piece in us. And if I can get this huge deal and all I've got to do is swear by Baal, I think I can handle that. I don't really believe in Baal, but if this big, big cheese guy here who wants to make me this great deal believes in Baal, maybe I can believe in Baal. And then he says, "Yeah, but you don't have to believe in Baal. You've got to come to the Friday night Baal service because we're buddies now. And if you want the deal, you've got to hang with me." And so you go down on Friday night to the Baal deal and drink some wine. And then they start singing songs to Baal. And then out come the prostitutes. Because remember, what happened with Baal worship, and the reason there were prostitutes there is that... the biggest thing if you're a farmer is to have fertile land, that your crops will grow. So the reason prostitutes were important around those ancient gods is by having sex with a prostitute, you were acting out the fact that Baal would inseminate the land and make it fertile. So that's what was acted out there with some of that, and so it was a fertility deal. So the danger is you go from Baal be with our deal to singing songs to Baal, and of course the Israelites had two problems. Number one, they were farmers; they certainly wanted fertile land, and number two, they were red-blooded Israelites. And that's a deadly combination. They stood to prosper financially, and they were red-blooded Israelite men who are susceptible like everyone. So you got to always watch out for the narrow end of the wedge. There's always a danger, of course, that we can segregate ourselves. So in our culture today, we use the phrase, "I'm in the world, but I'm not of the world." And I think that's a very important biblical phrase that actually was used by Jesus. We're in the world, but we're not of the world. But that's a delicate dance, because you've got to be careful of that thing. And everyone kind of lives it out slightly separately. Yeah, well, that's always a...
There was a series, there was a group of secretaries on space station, McDonald's, that was when I was there, and they were the payoff if you went along with the program, the lies. And I told my friend who was doing the software for the robotic arm on the shuttle around the space station, and I said, "You got to get out of here. It's going to pull the handbrakes on the wall."
You have to, now, the thing that we have to be careful of is, I mean, that's absolutely true. You've got to be so careful. You know what happens? You're doing a deal with this guy. He likes you. Let's go to Vegas. Let's celebrate. Let's do this. You've got to be careful. Now, the other thing you have to remember, though, that everyone has a different rejection factor. You know, I can't watch sexual scenes in movies because I have a weak rejection factor. I'm a red-blooded African. So I don't go to movies anymore. A lot of people can. A lot of people have something. They can watch a scene that doesn't mean anything to them, and they can move on. So you've got to be careful of being critical of folks who can have. Some people can go to Vegas, celebrate big time with some people, and it doesn't affect their faith at all. So we have to be careful. Each one of us is individual about that. But we've just got to be really careful that compromise can lead you down the path. Noble?
Well, this may be a sticking wicket, but Romney, of course, is Mormon. And I've talked to some people that won't even support, won't even say they won't vote for Romney because of that. But, you know, what do we do?
Well, but at least he's married to the same woman, which is rare in politics nowadays. It's hard to know. And it's hard to know. You know, I see a separation of church and state. So this may be not. I have more problems with the people who've been married to multiple wives. But, you know, everybody's slightly different. So the thing to be careful of is that just be careful. And this is something we older people need to see that chore. For instance, I have never. Now, remember, I'm kind of old-fashioned. I have never eaten a meal with a woman of the opposite sex on my own. Never, ever. 43 years. I never do it. If a woman salesman wants to take me out to eat, I just say no, or I take my paralegal with me, or Tina comes with me. I never do it. Period. End of story. I just made up my mind a long time ago. I think I read Billy Graham did it, and I never do it. Just never, ever. If a woman comes to my office, the door's wide open, and my paralegal has instructions. She can walk in any time she wants. I just don't do it. Now, my son Paul, who is one of the most godly young men in the world, thinks I'm extreme. He thinks I'm extreme in that. Dad, he said, don't you trust me? I said, Paul, you got the same Jesus as your dad, man. Be careful. Be careful. So, but you know, his generation is a little bit more tricky. You have an investment banker lady come in to raise capital for your company from, you know, Goldman Sachs or some big outfit, and she says, "Hey, let's go out to eat." Let me call my wife. it's a little tricky. So each person has to make up their own mind how to do that. I just made up my mind a long time ago. I just never do that. I've had paralegals work for me for 10 years, and I've never eaten lunch with them. It was just the two of us ever. And in fact, when Michelle, who just left me because she got married, was with me 6.5 years, and Yvette came, she said to Yvette, "Now, I've been here for 6.5 years. Brian will never take you out to eat. He just doesn't do that. I'm sorry. He's nice. He'll treat you well, pay you well, but he never takes you out to eat." I just decided that. We don't go to movies. The movies don't bother Tina. She can watch all that stuff. She's not a red-blooded. I just don't go to movies anymore. To me, I told you, I watched that Titanic. I can still see that scene in my mind. Remember in the Titanic, that scene where they go into the car and have sex, and that they manipulated your emotions, that you're cheering for two unmarried people to have sex because of the way they manipulate your emotions. And I got mad at them. And I walked out and said, "I'm going to show Hollywood a thing or two. I'm going to boycott them." And you can see how they have suffered since I boycotted them. However, my sons still think I'm quaint. I think they're careful of that. But so be careful. Be careful. And again, I tell my boys this. They don't always listen to me, but they listen a little bit because they watched our marriage. They know it works. And so they do that. Okay. So he warns them that don't associate with those people. Don't even mention the names of their God. And by the way, we don't worship the same God as the Muslims, just in case you're interested. Okay, rather, cling tightly to the Lord your God as you've done until now. Cling tightly is the deal. Okay, 9. 4, now he comes back to some encouragement again. For the Lord has driven out great and powerful nations for you, and no one has been able to defeat you. God has been with you. He's faithful. Each one of you will put to flight 1,000 of your enemies, for the Lord your God fights with you just as he has promised. And again, he's just reminding them of God's grace and his faithfulness and his mercy and his promises. If this is written in the new covenant, you say, remember how Christ died for you on the cross and paid the penalty for your sins. Remember how he rose again from the dead. Remember how the Holy Spirit came. Remember how you trusted Christ. Remember the sense of forgiveness of sins you had. Remember how he led you to your wife. Remember how he gave you kids. Remember how all the great things God has done for us. So, verse 11, be very careful to love the Lord your God. He's already told us to be obedient. Love the Lord your God. Obviously, love is loyal commitment. Be loyally committed to God. Be exclusively and loyally committed to God. Only one God. He doesn't tolerate any infidelity. One God. Be careful to be loyal to him. You know, I read an illustration the other day that said, for a lot of us, God is like our Norton security system on our computer. It sort of plays in the background and keeps us safe, but we don't pay a lot of attention to it. I thought there's a pretty interesting analogy there. Sort of there, sort of protects us. It's in the background, but we don't sort of focus on it. It's not our home page. Jesus needs to be our home page. Okay, verse 12. Now he ramps up from don't associate with these people because of the downward flow to don't intermarry with them. But if you turn away from him and cling to the customs of the survivors of these nations remaining among you, and if you intermarry with them, so you've not only now clung to their customs, you know, and sort of compromised, but you're now going to allow your children to intermarry with them, then know for certain, know for certain that the Lord your God, Yahweh, your Elohim, will no longer drive them out of your land. Instead, they will become a snare and a trap to you, a whip for your backs and thorny brambles for your eyes. And worse, you will vanish from this good land that the Lord your God has given you and you fought so hard for. You waited for 600 years. You fought so hard for. You, God has given it to you. If you compromise and follow the customs of the world around you and allow your children to intermarry with them, it's all over. Everything you have banked on is gone. Intermarrying was the problem that plagued the nation of Israel from all the way through, man. It took Solomon down and the judges that took them down. This intermarrying, it has nothing to do with racial or ethnic marrying. It's got nothing to do with that. It's got to do with believers marrying non-believers. That's what it has to do with. It's got nothing to do with black, white, yellow, any of those kind of things. It's got to do with believers marrying unbelievers. And that's really important for us to communicate to our children and grandchildren. That Lexi, you know, Grandma and I have built our marriage, you know, on trusting the Lord Jesus as our Savior. We were only going to marry Christians. And your dad and your mom met each other at college. And they were co-leaders of Campus Crusade for Christ. And they've got married. And you know, your family's followed Christ because, and you've grown up in a great family here. And Lexi, you can't date non-Christians. It's too dangerous. You got to do that. And Grandpa and I, and Grandpa and I, Tina would tell her, we're praying that God will give you a husband at the right time. But you must marry a Christian. Just in your conversation. Their parents say that. Their youth leader hopefully says it. It should become something that's really important. And the positives, not that we're holding back on something, but that your grandpa and your the reason you like coming to grandpa and grandma's house because it's a cool house. Fun things happen there. Your parents have raised a cool house because they're believers. You need to do that. And we just need it. The danger of intermarriage is incredible. Now, we can't hog-tie our children. God gives them a freedom to make their own choices. All we can do is encourage them and help them along the way. But we do need to do that. And then we do have tricky situations if you have somebody who is you raise them and then they marry a non-believer after all your counsel and advice. You know, you have to support them. They're still your children. You got to love them. You got to care for them. You got to be there for them. But we need to create a culture in which it's got nothing to do with black and white. It's got nothing to do with college degrees. It's got nothing to do with wealth. It's got nothing to do with those things. It has to do with faith in Christ. Because, you know, otherwise it's like two people meeting in Chicago at the airport. And the boy says to the girl, where are you going? And she says, I'm going to Los Angeles. And she says to him, where are you going? And he says, I'm going to New York. And they say, great, let's go together. You can't do it. You can't do it. Marriage is challenging enough when you have two believers who marry with the same values and the same commitment to Christ and the same infrastructure around them. If you have non-Christian, if you have this unequal yoke. And of course, the Apostle Paul said that too, didn't he? What did he say? Yeah, or he says, do not be yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship does Christ have with Belial? Now, the context may not have been marriage, but the context certainly had to do with worshiping of different idols. And a non-Christian that our children or nieces or nephews or whatever would marry has other idols. They just don't bow down to them, but it may be a surfboard, it may be a car, it may be skiing, it may be money, it may be, you know, it's all kinds of things because we all kind of do something. We've got to be fearless to do that. Okay, we're winding down here. Okay, now verse 14. Verse 14, this is his third reiteration, goes through the same. Except in his third reiteration, he's reminded them about grace several times. Now he just goes right into his third warning. Obey God, and particularly don't associate. Be careful of the compromise. Be careful of the compromise. And I would say to you, you know, we all have different ways we can go. Some people can drink one glass of wine and then they become vulnerable to do stupid things. Other people can drink 10 glasses of wine and they're as fine as anything. Everyone's different. So we've got to be careful of judging other people. We've got to look after what we're like. Some people can go to R-rated movies, doesn't bother them. Some people it does. Some people go to Vegas and cut loose, doesn't bother them. Some people it does. But we need to know where we are and share that with our children. Don't intermarry. None of you here look like you're about to get married in the next little while, but don't intermarry. I could make a real sermon on this one. Encourage your children. For most of us, it's grandchildren now. Folks we come in contact with, you've got to be a believer. Greg, actually, you may not remember this, but when you came to the office and Michelle had those flowers there. You may not remember this. She had the flowers there from this guy who she's now married to. Michelle's my paralegal. And Greg says, oh, who are those flowers from? And Michelle says, oh, the flowers are from Jay. And Greg said, oh, you're getting serious with him? Yes. And she said, yes, I think I'm falling for him. And Greg's next question was, is he a believer? And she said, yes. And Greg said, well, you got the heavy stuff taken care of. It'll work. Pretty cool, huh? That was cool. It was great encouragement to her, too. So that was pretty cool. Okay, verse 14. soon I will die. You only do that if I haven't listened to you for years on end. You pull out the trump card. I may die soon. Listen, dude. Soon I will die, going the way of everything on earth. And then he says, again, there's a little bit of grace here. Deep in your hearts, you know that every promise of the Lord your God has been true. I mean, you know God is true. Deep in your hearts, you know you've seen it. Not a single one has failed. But as surely as the Lord your God has given you the good things he promised, and you've experienced them, man. I mean, if there's ever a highlight of Israel's history, it's this conquest of the land. You've experienced them. These were high times. As surely as he's given you the good things he promised, so he will also bring disaster on you if you disobey him. He will completely destroy you from the good land he has given you. If you break the covenant of the Lord your God by worshiping and serving other gods, his anger will burn against you and you'll quickly vanish from the good land he has promised you. So, salvation is by grace in the promises of God. We can't do anything to earn our salvation. We can't obey our way to our salvation. It's by grace in what he has provided, his faithfulness, his blessing to us that we receive by faith. But once we have received his gift of righteousness, his gift of salvation, his gift of forgiveness, and the Holy Spirit has come to live in our lives, and we've been assured of eternal life, we have an obligation to obey him, to cling tightly to him. And if we obey him and cling tightly to him and don't deviate to the left or the right, don't compromise in a path that'll take us down, don't get entangled, because we talked about intermarrying with people, but many of us intermarry socially, financially. We get ourselves intricately involved with folks whose values are completely different from ours, force us to make decisions that are really, really difficult. I remember I once worked for a company, which is a really tricky thing. I mean, you guys have all had this many years ago. I was legal counsel to a company where one of the guys was leaving, and I negotiated his severance package. And the severance package was to pay him X amount of money. I forget what it was. And then the owners of the company came to me and said, we're going to personally guarantee the severance. I said, you don't need to do that. I've negotiated where you don't have, the company can do it. Oh, no, we want to do that because we want the company to pay us a guarantee fee. Because they had a fund that allowed them to use that. So I said, I knew these guys. I said, wow. I said, that puts me in a really difficult, awkward deal. I said, you know, I specifically negotiated so there was not a personal guarantee. Because, I mean, I was trying to protect the company. Plus, I knew the company had the money to pay it. You don't need a guarantee. I said, I know, but we need $100,000 each. Because we need a guarantee fee. So I said, you know, I don't think I can do that. I said, okay, we'll get this other lawyer here down the hall, and he can do that. We understand that, and you don't understand. There's a long history of this, why, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And they said, we'll take care of it, and we managed to finesse our way through it. Now, I worked with those guys for a long time after that, and I never saw them do anything close to that again. So be careful of being too judgmental, because people don't back down very easily on this event. Once they've made up their mind they're going to do something on this event, they're not going to back down. But sometimes what you say graciously, I didn't say I'm going to quit. I'm going to tell everyone. I just said, God, I'm uncomfortable. I kind of made it look like I was the one with the problem, not them. Never saw them do anything like that again. So sometimes making a stand graciously, not in a way that confronts, but a way that sort of says it, but in a gracious, non-confrontive way, gets a message across where it doesn't happen again. And that's really life. My life, you can't write books about my life. My life is successful about the third or fourth time around. I never have great stories where people fall to their knees and say, yeah, Brian, you're right. I'm going to change my whole life. And it doesn't work that way. You know, but slowly things happen. So you got to remember, often when you do that first confrontation with your children or your grandchildren or whatever it is, not confrontation, they're not going to always say, oh, Grandpa, you're so wise. I'm going to abandon my boyfriend of 2 years and go to youth group on Friday night. Life's not like that. You know, over time, things slowly happen. So you've got to be gracious about it. Yes.
You gave them the standard and the example that they had to recognize.
This is a long time ago. I don't think there's any of you here that can connect the dots. One of those guys was a Christian guy who was coming to a Bible study that I was teaching at the time. The other guy, we had been trying to get to go to church for years and never did. But the other guy, the one who didn't go to church, this is back when I was at Mariners, and I used to preach at Mariners there. He came to hear me preach every time I preached. Now, he is he goes every Wednesday morning to the men's Bible study at Mariners. He and his wife, it's his second wife, are totally committed to Christ and to the church. At the time this happened, though, he was really unhappy with us Christian guys taking over his company. So you never know how slowly these things can happen. But it happened. Now, I've got lots of other stories that are not that great. Please understand. Most of my stories don't work. We preachers always tell stories that work. And you think our lives are like that. Our lives are not like that. Most of my stories don't work. Most of the people that I tell you doing something wrong, they say, okay, adios, see you later, dude. I'll find somebody else. My stories don't normally work. They just occasionally work by God's grace in that thing. And then be careful of you know, worshiping other gods. When we were young and energetic, we were always tempted to the gods of successes.